Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Last week, the country held its breath as the Supreme Court decided whether to vote down Obamacare. Since then, many have weighed in on the implications of what this decision will mean for the 449.9 million uninsured persons, 16.3% of the U.S. population. Some say this decision paves the way for universal health care. Some say it will impede the path toward universal health care. Most agree that the program falls short of what's needed. How bad is it? What will it mean for you? And what will it take politically for this country to adopt the system that successfully serves most of the developed world? Think you've heard it all? Stay tuned. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, political economist Jeff Fawcett. And we also have with us in studio Henry L. Abrams, who is a physician and also has a master's in public health. His last name is A-B-R-O-N-S. He's a graduate of Harvard College and Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. He trained and worked at public hospitals in New York City, Chicago, Morgantown, which is in West Virginia, and Oakland, California, and is a specialist in pulmonary disease and critical care medicine. In 2007, he took up full-time volunteer work for healthcare reform. He's on the board of Physicians for a National Health Program at PNHP.org, and he's president of the California chapter. He believes that a single-payer, improved Medicare for All program is the only sustainable way to provide universal access to affordable, high-quality health care. So now to today's topic, abomination care. So let's start with Dr. Abrams. Henry, welcome to you.
I'm very glad to be here, Elena.
I need you to make sure that you're close enough to your microphone there.
Okay.
That's better. Yes. So I'm wondering whether we might start with a question about whether this is actual progress. I read Dr. Marcia Angel's Huffington Post, which you have posted on the PNHP.org website, dated June 29th, called "Did John Roberts Give Mitt Romney a Gift?" And what she talks about is that the program will actually raise all consumer costs and give the Republicans ground to again attack Obama for raising taxes. Could you comment?
Well, I could comment, but I want to just say that I'm really not a political pundit. So I view this primarily through the lens of what effect the Affordable Care Act is going to have on healthcare delivery. Also, what is it? What are we likely to see in terms of affordability of healthcare? And really, to flip it around, the stress caused by the difficulties in obtaining healthcare and paying for it. Those difficulties, of course, are experienced by individuals and families. They're experienced by employers, communities, everybody who pays taxes. So really, that's a widespread social problem. And those are two things that I feel I have an understanding of, partly from my many years as a practicing physician and also as a student of healthcare reform. The politics, I have no particular qualifications, so I'd be glad to make some comments.
Why don't we let Jeffrey, since he does, he's a political economist, let's let him comment on the Marcia Angel article, because I think we're kind of a political show, and I think the politics of this situation are important.
Well, first of all, I would like to say, Henry, that I believe that you are qualified, particularly from the standpoint of the point that Marcia Angel makes, one of the two major points, which is that from her perspective, the Supreme Court decision upholding the individual mandate is going to lead to increasing costs, which is going to lead to increasing difficulties for people to get care because of the way in which the healthcare system works. And I have actually forgotten where I believe it was Margaret Flowers who made a comment after a summary of the Supreme Court decision, that one of the effects of this is going to be that as people find it rational, economically rational, financially rational to opt out, pay the tax, that insurance companies are going to restrict actual care through the specific form that they do by paying for procedures as opposed to general health. And as since there are no regulatory controls over premiums in this legislation, what is going to happen is premiums are going to go up, and they're going to go up for everyone. So even if you have insurance, the effect upon you is going to be twofold. One, it's going to become more expensive, and secondly, it's going to become more restrictive. In fact, there was an article to that effect in the New York Times, published in the New York Times today. So I would like to hear your thoughts on how the politics have affected the finances, and how the finances are going to affect the actual care, and how it is is reasonable to expect this to be a kind of downward spiral, that both care is going to get worse and the finances are going to get worse as this Affordable Care Act proceeds in its implementation.
Well, I agree with what you're highlighting, but those are trends that have been taking place really over many decades in healthcare. So we've reached the point now where we, for example, know that insurance companies depend on making a profit and limiting the care that they pay for, while at the same time trying to capture the greatest possible number of premium dollars. So that's a business model that basically profits from really not giving health care, but selling health insurance and denying care. And that's going to continue. There's nothing that's going to change as a result of the Affordable Care Act, because the Affordable Care Act really was built on expanding the existing system of for-profit private health insurance. Of course, it's also going to expand government subsidized health insurance, but that's something that also is a long-term trend. The government now pays more than 50% of the entire national health expenditure in this country. So we really have very vast public programs. Medicare, everyone is familiar with, for the elderly and for the certain segments of the disabled population. Medicaid, which I think you know, is a lifeline for people of low income, but let's recognize, I find it quite troubling that in a country that claims to honor the principle of equal opportunity, we have a separate healthcare program for the poor that doesn't give them equal opportunity to get the same healthcare that everybody else gets. They get some healthcare, and it's absolutely better than nothing, but it's not equal healthcare. It is more restricted. There are great difficulties, which we can talk about later, from the standpoint of both patients and providers, that make this a very troubled and rocky system. And then another very big government program, of course, is the Veterans Administration, which everyone in our country should point to with pride, because here not only are we giving it to a very worthy group of people, but the care that they receive in a system that actually is an example of socialized medicine. That is, the government owns the facilities and employs all of the workers in those facilities, professional and other, on a salaried basis. So it's entirely a socialized model, and it actually delivers superior health care to any other form of coverage. It's better than Medicare. It's better than private insurance. The outcome, the statistics for patients in the VA system are actually the best that we can point to in the United States.
Well, it also matches up with what we see in Canada and other places where they have health care for all. I think one of the concerns here about, you know, there's what Marcia Angell is pointing out is that maybe we would have been better off if the Supreme Court had overturned this mandate, because what may happen now, or what is going to happen now, is that the insurance companies are simply not going to allow their costs to go up and not hand that down. So they're going to be demanding that the penalties for not being insured go up. They're going to increase deductibles and copays will increase to the point where even if you have insurance, you won't be able to use it. And this is what's happening apparently in Massachusetts. And employers will simply stop offering health insurance. And then, you know, there'll be additional situations like this, and it will fall upon the government to police all of this. But it's additionally going to probably decrease some of the money that goes to hospitals and other care facilities that accept Medicaid and Medicare, since there's going to be issues with that. I mean, there's a litany of things that are likely to just blow up in our faces as a result of this. And it's very disappointing because I think some people up on the left were initially thrilled with this, and now it seems as though this may have actually gotten in the way of people being so angry that they actually move forward on national health care. Let me just tell you, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, and we're on the phone with Dr. Henry Abrams, A-B-R-O-N-S, from the Physicians for National Healthcare Programs, PNHP. So, Dr. Abrams, any comments? Do you think we're better off with the ruling?
Well, it depends which we were referring to. So what is being, you know, touted and with some degree of truth is that there are individuals, there are families who have benefited from the Affordable Care Act and will be better off. But if we're interested in the question of the best health care system, the best health care delivery available for the people of our country, if we start from a desire to take care of one another, to relieve the suffering of our neighbors, our communities, our families, and ourselves, and to have a safe and secure society, if that's our objective, then this act has fallen far, far short and been a great disappointment right from the start. And we knew that in 2009 from the approach that was being taken by, I would say, the power structure in Congress, the president, and frankly, the media. I think the press really fell in line with the idea that, you know, was really representing the consensus of the power structure, which is to leave private for-profit health insurance alone and then try to jury-rig around it a very complicated network of band-aids, of patches, to take care of this abuse and that defect, frankly, to then start talking of misrepresenting it in order to sell it to the public as a system that was going to cover everybody. And people are still saying this. I mean, people that should know better are still saying, you know, now everybody has coverage. Well, that's not true. And in some cases, I think people say it because they're simply confused. This is a very complex bill. It in print was over 2,000 pages. Compared to the simplicity of a single-payer health care program, which can be written down in 20 or 30 pages and can actually be understood by you don't have to have a law
degree. Mere mortals.
Yeah, mere mortals. Mere doctors can look at a single-payer bill and say, that's elegant. That makes sense. That expresses a real solution to what we're trying to do, which is to provide people, everyone, with the health care that will benefit them and that is really necessary. Not frills, not unproven therapy. That is in the realm of research. But therapy that is shown to be the right treatment, whether it's for diabetes or sore throat or
right.
cancer, this is what we're trying to
yeah.
do. And we have we have wonderful technology. We have brilliant scientists. We have dedicated doctors,
yeah.
nurses, and therapists.
Okay.
We should be able to do this. So, back to the question of, you know, what should people think of this bill?
Well, that wasn't the question.
Yeah.
So
okay.
if you could hold off a minute, I will ask that question in a moment. I'd like to get Jeffrey's input on something. So single payer, you know, is slated to, single payer is, as Dr. Abrams says, is elegant because it eliminates administrative costs for the most part. It, we're already paying taxes, so we're actually already paying for health care with our taxes, so we're already being taxed to pay for that. We've got all this nonsense with computerized medical records and chronic disease management has not saved money, and so, among other things, the way to slash administrative overhead is to have a single payer. But I would think, after reading about this issue, that this new Obamacare program is, now that it's in place, it may actually impede our progress toward this in some way. So that's what I'm concerned with. So what do you think? Do you think that Marcia Angel is right? Do you think that this it would have been better if this had been voted down?
Yes. That's a simple answer. The reason is that everyone is now committed to saving the Affordable Care Act. And a great deal of political capital is going to be expended on doing that. Which means that there is an even greater commitment now, because this is now Barack Obama's legacy. There's going to be a great deal of political force to maintain it, which means, and the important point here is that the Affordable Care Act commits us as a nation to maintaining the private insurance structure of delivering health care. One of the things that was bothersome to me and about the outcome is that there was a lot of discussion and celebration on the left about how this is now the next stage to single payer, and it in fact is not. Because it is, it has committed the politics in this situation to maintaining the current system. It would have been, as soon as this went before the Supreme Court, I maintained that it would be better to rule it out, and I even hoped that the five conservative justices would do that, and we got tricked. And from my perspective, I thought the position of Physicians for National Health Program was extremely brave in calling that shot, in saying that putting our energies behind reforming a bad reform is not going to be the path forward. The path forward is going to be actually aggressively pursuing a single payer system. The Affordable Care Act is not a stepping stone to single payer. It's something to be overcome in order to get to single payer. That's my opinion anyway.
So, Dr. Abrams, I understand that part of what you, I mean, I understand that you are a very, very strong advocate for national single payer. And so I think, but I think that you wanted to say a bit about what parts of the Affordable Care Act actually might be beneficial, even though I think both Jeff and I are concerned that what's going to happen is as these benefits start to impact the profits of the insurance companies, that they will be pulled out from under, and that, and we've already seen, you know, Florida is now refusing to do a good deal of the things in the act. But nevertheless, you felt, I think, you wanted to express what you thought might be valuable and has been already valuable about the Affordable Care Act for some people.
Well, actually, Lena, I didn't want to run that down in detail because it's been done exhaustively. We've heard it's a litany that we've heard, you know, on every show and read in every commentary, you know, about the children staying on their parents' insurance until they're 26, and about prohibition of denial of insurance for pre-existing conditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't want to dwell on those things. If people want to see those things spelled out, they can simply go to healthcare.gov, which is the federal government's healthcare website, which explains all the things that the president and Congress, the Democrats at least, and Nancy Pelosi, et cetera, you know, are so proud of. I just wanted to acknowledge that because there are some people who do get some benefits, but I think in terms of healthcare policy, no, I think the act is a dismal failure. I completely agree with Marshall Angel, and I agree with Jeffrey, that people whose expectations have been lifted are going over time to be sorely disappointed. But unfortunately, I think many people in this country follow the saying of Winston Churchill, who said Americans always end up doing the right thing after they've tried everything else. And so there are a lot of people in this country who, you know, are going to wake up at some point in the future and say, we made a great mistake. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my question is, or rather my focus and my organization's focus, Physicians for National Health Program, is we've already said all of these things, mm-hmm. and we've actually said them not just on the basis of opinion, but we have exhaustive research that people can access by going to the National PNHP website, pnhp.org, and they can look up research studies that will show what is the effect of the individual mandate on healthcare costs in Massachusetts. How good is the coverage that all of these additional people are actually getting? And what you find out is it's skimpy, defective insurance that will leave many people holding the bag and having to pay enormous costs, unaffordable costs, out of their own pockets. What is the effect on bankruptcy? Medical debt is the probably the single greatest cause of personal bankruptcies in the United States. And it's not debt incurred by people who had no health insurance.
Right.
It's almost all people who had health insurance, yep, for the very condition that drove them into indebtedness. But their health insurance wasn't adequate, or it was canceled during the illness, and then they end up, you know, in a personal disaster. So all of that has been said. We've researched it as much as possible. We've tried to, get the findings out there and especially bring them to the attention of policymakers and also to the attention of organizations that are organizing for social change. And frankly, a lot of the organizations that call themselves progressive and call themselves left, I think, have been seduced into taking the easy path and supporting the Democratic Party and supporting the president, and have ignored these findings.
That's clear.
And we've tried to stick to our clear message. So right now our focus is on, well, where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. And Jeffrey really summed it up. We are going to continue fighting as hard as possible for single payer and getting there as quickly as possible, because nothing else will work. And so the question really is, you know, are people willing to listen to us, and what can we do to promote the development of an effective movement? And I don't see it as a left or progressive question, really. I think that single payer is in the interests of Republicans. Mm-hmm. It's in the interests of the Tea Party, if they would,
yeah,
you know, only
it's
come to
popular.
Their senses.
Yes, right.
And it's in the interests of big business, small business. So, and it's in the interests of the Democrats. And the Democrats, I think, have, you know, in my own opinion, not done the party proud. I think they've done damage to Democratic beliefs by taking this easy road of accomplishing something simply because it was the lowest common denominator, and they could then go around waving their banners and saying, look at all that we accomplished. But if you look at what they didn't accomplish and what they could have accomplished, I'm not proud.
Yeah, I think Jeff had a quick comment.
Well, not so much a comment. It's something that I hope we will be exploring more after a break that's going to happen in a couple of minutes. But one of the things that I note from your website, from the California chapter's website, is that the California Democratic Party supports single payer in the state. We know that Vermont is about to put into effect legislation that it passed, but that in California, even though the Democratic Party, which has a lot of control in the state, failed to pass, we had a near miss recently. So one of the directions I wanted to discuss is what the relationship is between these various state movements for single payer and the national movement, and how those become integrated. The reason being that, to use the word, people forget that progressives 100 years ago were Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So I look back to the progressive era and what happened with regulatory, with the rise of national regulation, which responded principally by corporations who were being controlled at the state level, and national regulation became a way for corporations to protect themselves. So that's kind of lead into,
yeah,
what I'd like to have a discussion about in the second half of the show.
All right, so when we come back from break, we'll pick that up. We're going to just need to take a very quick break here. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. We're talking about Abomination Care. And we have Jeff Fawcett, PhD, here, and Dr. Henry Abrams, A-B-R-O-N-S, from the Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP.org, PNHP.org. We're going to break for 30 seconds or so. Please stay with us. I'm Lena Berman. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, and we are on the phone today with Dr. Henry Abrams, A-B-R-O-N-S, from Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. Go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows. Check out the changes to our library card feature and find out about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more. yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can reach us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. And again, it's pnhp.org for the physicians for a national health program. So, Jeffrey, if you could restate what it was that you wanted to talk about quickly.
Oh, well, before we took the break, what I've been looking at with interest is how this reminds me of regulatory and legislative actions that were taking place over 100 years ago when national agencies like the Federal Trade Commission and FDA and a lot of national regulatory bodies were established in response to, call it a hodgepodge, but state-level regulatory and regulatory actions that were being taken, largely in response to popular uprisings against the effect of corporate actions. And so that what that puts me in mind of is strategically, what is the Physicians for National Health Program? What now is the strategy? Because you have in all but about 8 states, you have organizations there that are working to advance single payer, some form of universal health care in the states. So I'd like to know from your perspective, both in California and from the national perspective, what is happening and how might people be able to get involved in promoting single payer, not only at the national level, but in particular at the local level or at the state level.
Mm-hmm. Well, PNHP, I think, really has two main thrusts. One is to represent a voice for clarity regarding policy, and also to analyze, you know, what is going on, and to disseminate the research in the field, much of which is done by PNHP leaders, acting in their capacities as scientists and doctors and professors of health policy and so forth. And then the other thing that we do is we do try to organize in order to achieve social change. I mean, we want a single-payer healthcare system to come into being as quickly as possible because we're primarily doctors, and we see that there's avoidable suffering going on that could be changed the moment that we implement a single-payer program. We know that there are approximately 50,000 deaths in this country simply due to the fact that people don't have insurance coverage. We know that more veterans died in the past several years from lack of health insurance than died in the Iraq conflict. So these are absolutely devastating and shameful realities that we understand every time we walk into an exam room and see a patient and hear that they have limitations in terms of their insurance coverage, or that we have to then leave the exam room and go to the telephone or the computer and fight with their insurance company to get them the health care that we know that they need.
So can you explain how single payer will get rid of all of that? Because it would seem, I think, to a lot of people who are concerned, who aren't sold on single payer, although most of the listening audience is sold on single payer, but some people feel that what's going to happen is you're going to trade having corporations in your business, in the exam room. You're going to trade that for having the government in your exam room saying, well, do you really need that procedure? And, no, that's, you know, what about, you know, then it costs money and this and that. So it's which you're kind of trading a bureaucrat for a corporation, you know, being in control. And people are concerned about that. So what do you say to people who are worried?
Well, what I say to them is that nothing is easy. But who owns the government? Now that raises the question, I guess, of the current absolutely critical problem that we face in our society, which is that corporations have captured to a great extent control of the government and control of politics and control of the media. But so either way, really, we're fighting corporations. It's just that I know that I'm a stakeholder in I actually hire and fire my elected representatives every election day, along with all of the other people who exercise their right to vote. And I have no control over Blue Cross Blue Shield. There's no reason why they should listen to me. And they're not in the business of taking care of me. They're in the business of making money for their shareholders. Whereas at least the government is an entity that is in the business of helping all of us to accomplish the things that we can't do as individuals or in small groups. We can't build roads privately. We can't fight forest fires and put them out privately. We can't have public education without having a government, and we can't have a healthcare system without having a government. Now, will there be bureaucracy? You bet. Will there be regulations? You bet. But I will have a voice. Doctors will have a voice. The public will have a voice. Nurses, taxpayers, policy people, economists, and so on, and we will all come together. Other countries have done this. I mean, it's not like
it's very successful in other places.
Absolutely. Right. So no one is saying that public administration and accomplishing things through a political process is easy, but we just have to recognize that in terms of healthcare administration and setting up a healthcare system, it is the only way. We have no other choice.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think your question is, what is single payer? Should I address?
Okay. Wait. Let Jeff comment. Then we'll go back to that.
Well, let me ask a focus question. Currently, my understanding of the legislative proposals, particularly H.R. 676, which is the current national Medicare for All legislation carried by John Conyers, that its provisions set up a national body, which I think is called the Health Policy Board. But that is the policymaking body which sets healthcare policy for the nation, which would be the umbrella organization for running the single payer. I may be mistaken about this, but it's I was looking for it this morning before we started the show. But it seems to me that one of the things that Physicians for National, the organization, has called for is. And that at least single payer would allow, if it wasn't even a part of the legislation, is that one of the problems that we're in right now with current practice and how the finances, as I said at the beginning of the show, how finances affect the actual care, this issue of who's in the exam room with you. It's not just the doctor, it's the insurance company. And at least the potential, if not the actual fact of single payer, makes it possible for physicians and other health practitioners to be reimbursed not on a procedure basis, but on a health outcomes basis.
Right.
It's it creates the possibility of, you know what, you get paid based on how well your patients are. Not whether you give them this test or that test or so on.
Yeah, so it's less standard of care and more about sort of the Chinese model of the doctor gets paid only when the patient is not visiting him.
Yeah. Yes. Right. So I would like to hear your comments on the extent to which Physicians for a National Health Program have been advocating for not just that narrowly focused financial part of who's paying the bill, the medical bills, but how the actual form of payment, what practitioners are being paid, how they are being paid, affects the quality of care.
Well, we don't take a single position on reimbursement for providers, and the reason for that is that we actually feel that a tremendous amount of good could simply come from giving everybody 100% of the people residing in the United States from birth to death access to all of the medical care that's necessary. And that's our primary focus. Now, the question of delivery system reform and reimbursement reform is a very worthy question, and it's a process that will need to go on over an extended period of time. But we could have national, universal, publicly financed health care tomorrow. And while this other process continues, so we feel that there are many excellent points to be, you know, worked out in terms of incentives, removing perverse incentives to simply do more care, more procedures that don't benefit the patient. We're absolutely against that. And we do want to create incentives to improve patient outcome and patient satisfaction as well. I think it's not just a question of, you know, what was the glucose reading in a diabetic patient, or the hemoglobin A1C, or what was the blood pressure, or what was the, you know, survival statistic in cancer patients. But I think that in addition to those measurable outcomes where you can sort of take a yardstick and measure it, I think that one of the qualities of a good healthcare system is that the people served by that system are satisfied, because people go to healthcare providers to have their anxieties, their questions, their uncertainties, their insecurities, their desire for the ability to manage their own illness and to gain some control over their lives. They go for those things as well, and those aren't always, you know, subject to easy, discreet management by someone who's a bean counter. So delivery system reform is definitely something we're interested in. We don't take a stand. We say that there are many virtues in having a capitated system, and that Kaiser would be a good example of that. So the healthcare organization receives so much money per person covered per year, and then there's an incentive to use that money in a you know, in a cost-effective way, but obviously there have to be checks and balances because the organization doesn't get to withhold care and keep the remainder, the leftovers, so you don't want that kind of incentive. But we also are not at this point coming out against continuation of the fee-for-service system. We recognize that there are, you know, it's fraught with some possible bad features, but we feel that, you know, most, this is a money-driven system right now, and we feel that if we get to a single-payer system, that most healthcare providers, whether they're doctors, therapists, health educators, whatever, didn't go into their profession and are not primarily driven by money. There are some people who are, and the current system promotes that.
Right.
But we really think that most people work very hard, and they're primarily driven by a desire to help other people.
Okay, I have a comment this time. I think a big issue here is that the profit-driven healthcare system that we now find ourselves in, which includes the Kaiser model, which was supposed to be managed healthcare, which was supposed to provide a lot of services for a controlled price. It was the Costco of healthcare. In fact, instead turned into a system that relies stringently on standard of care, and is actually quite behind in even reading their own research in terms of what tests they will allow people to have. So they actually, as I said before, manage not to care. It's sort of managed care is managing not to provide care. So we've got a crisis in the healthcare system that is more complex than just a financial or economic crisis, and it has to do with the decline in care. And some of this is because doctors are being reined in by both the HMOs and the insurance companies to a point where they can't actually answer people's questions or even entertain the possibility of doing a very simple, inexpensive test. They have to justify everything. So there's been a decline over the last 30, 40 years, and I think it's the profit model, but I think there's another problem, which is that because of the dominance of continuing education courses given by pharmaceutical companies, there's an enormous amount of overdiagnosis and overtreatment, and there's also a kind of overtreatment in terms of expensive invasive testing. And honestly, from where I sit on this side of the microphone, and because of the kind of consulting practice I have, what I hear from people is they call me up and they say, "So you're an educator, not a doctor?" I say, "Yes," and they say, "Good, I want to talk to you." Because they feel as if when they enter into the healthcare system, they're falling into a sticky web. And they can't get loose. They can't. They're sort of on this fast track for a lot of treatments they don't want. And I don't think that's just the profit model, although certainly the profit model has corrupted doctors' instinctive need or desire to care for people.
I don't disagree. I think that, you know, there's a strong movement that has existed for at least 40 years since I was a medical student, to, you know, get the influence of drug companies, the corporate profit-seeking interest of drug companies, out of the doctor-patient interaction. And it continues today, and it's been strengthened. And we still have a long way to go. Absolutely. There's no question that much of what you say needs further work. But many medical schools and most hospitals now do not allow pharmaceutical reps to sponsor lunches, to sponsor conferences, to bring materials, to basically leave little bribes for students and practicing physicians and pharmacists and so on. So there is a pushback against that, but I again think that to me the most pressing and most urgent and most fundamental moral question that we face is to get profit out of healthcare and to make sure that healthcare is provided as a social good, a social necessity for everybody in the country, and that we have one class of healthcare. We don't have different tiers of healthcare. You know, that it's absolutely a violation of our democratic principles that everybody should have equal opportunity. Well, everybody should have equal opportunity to get the same health care, not health care for the rich and a different system for the poor. And once we can't do everything at once. So that's where PNHP, and that's where I'm putting my energy. But at the same time, Lena, I absolutely agree with you that health education and getting this perversion, this corruption of healthcare service by people who really have a different motivation, that this has to be constantly fought, and eventually I think we'll be able to do a lot better once we don't have a healthcare delivery system that is money driven as it is now.
I think Jeffrey had something quick. Did you? Because
It wasn't quick. It had to do with folks out there are listening, thinking, okay, so what do I do now?
I do want to talk about that. But before we talk about that, I want to give Dr. Abrams a chance to talk about the aspects of a national. Another thing that I neglected to bring up is that the California Nurses Association and the Physicians for National Healthcare Program went on a road trip, and they went all over the place statewide. They went mostly within California only, or in any case, what they heard, because I spoke to a nurse about this who wasn't available for the show, that what they heard in these town hall meetings is that patients, citizens want national health care. As you say, it's now time for the 1%, for the 1% not to be the only people who get care, but the 99% to get care. And if the 1% want to fly to some other country to get some kind of transplant or something, they can do that. But I wanted to give you a chance to talk about the aspects of the national health care program that you guys are advocating for, that you're compelled by, and why you think it's going to work. I want to give you a chance to do that.
Why it will work?
Well, how it will work, why it will work, what it is. I wanted to give you some time to promote it.
And then hopefully we could spend a little time on what your listeners can do.
Very much so. So
because
few minutes,
Sam. What's driving this, I think, is not just the desire to, talk about something that's interesting and a challenging problem and so on, but to actually change our society. So the way it would work, first of all, we do think that it should be done on a national level, but because of the composition of Congress and the fact that the federal bill, H.R. 676, that Jeffrey referred to, is not going to go very far in the current Congress, and really until a lot of the people in Congress are willing to open their minds to the idea of single payer, whether Congress is Democratic or Republican, we still have an uphill battle. So that may take years, and in the meantime, state groupings, coalitions in Vermont and in California, but also in close to 20 other states, are pushing single-payer bills in their state legislatures. Now, to do single-payer in a state really requires that the state receive waivers from the federal government so that it can fold in to the single-payer program all of the different streams of revenue. So the basic idea is that you have one health care fund, and people pay a simple tax, and it's a progressive tax. And there's no more co-pays and deductibles. There are no more out-of-pocket expenses. When you go to the pharmacy to pick up your prescription, there's no money that changes hands. You've already paid for it. So people would pay through taxes. But we have all of these federal programs that are already paid through various forms of taxation. So we have money going to, for example, if we look at California, we have the funds that California receives from the federal government for Medi-Cal or Medicaid. We have the Medicare funds. And so we want to bring all of these funding streams, and there are many, many of them. It's an incredibly complex program, but some of it comes through real estate taxes, state and local taxes, sales taxes, and so forth. For example, our county hospital in Alameda County receives some money from a county sales tax. So all of these streams of money need to be channeled into a health care fund. Everybody gets a health care card, and then they pick the provider of their choice. And a wide range of providers is covered, both traditional doctors, but also it covers chiropractic care, it covers acupuncture, osteopaths who are really doctors and have the same license that MDs do are covered. Health education would be covered, dental and vision care, prescription medications, rehab care, nursing home, long-term care is sort of being worked out. But we want to cover the whole package, and you have your card, and that's your, that simply is all you need to present each time you need health care. And so you're just logged in, and the care is recorded under your identification, and then you go home until you need care again. And then if you go to a different provider, the providers are linked together by an effective electronic medical record system that secures your privacy. So that's the way single payer would work. People would have complete security. They wouldn't have to spend time trying to read those undecipherable and absolutely, tormenting medical bills. I can't understand my medical bills, and I only have about, 20 years of 24 years of education. How can anybody possibly understand the finances of the current medical care system? The other thing about a single payer system is that at the end of a time period, we can actually look and see how much did we really spend for health care and exactly where did the money go. Right now, it's constantly pointed out that we have no idea how the prices for healthcare services are actually set and
That's
where
important.
The money goes.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there's tremendous, it's a shell game.
Okay. So before we run out of time, what can we citizens do to make this happen?
Okay. So what we can do is we have to find an organization that we can, participate with or interact with or support that will be part of the coalition to work for single payer health care. So there are coalitions in the state. In California, we are building a coalition called the Campaign for a Healthy California. And the website is under construction, but it's www.healthycaliforniacampaign.org. And the organizations that are in this coalition, because we realize this is not something that can be accomplished by doctors. It has to be accomplished by a broad, determined movement, and it takes years to build this. So we have retirees in the California Alliance for Retired Americans. We have health professional students, 3,000 of them around the state. We have labor unions, including the Communication Workers, the California Nurses Association. We have political organizations, the Green Party, Democracy for America, Progressive Democrats. We have the League of Women Voters.
No, I'm sure it's a big list.
Yes, Single Payer Now and so forth. So Healthcare for All California. So
okay.
People can help to build this coalition. If they're interested, we are having a training session in Los Angeles.
Don't tell us the exact date because this will be played at different times, but it's on the website, is it?
It is on the website. If people would simply go to phpcalifornia.org, write it as one word, phnhpcalifornia.org, and they can get this information.
We'll put it on our website, too. So there'll be a little flag for this thing that's going to be happening?
Yes.
Okay.
And the bus tour that you mentioned, and then mm-hmm. also we have a movie showing for people in the Bay Area on Sunday, July 15th, to look at a very interesting movie that describes the Canadian healthcare system and compares it with the U.S.
Well, I really...
What's the title of the film?
The Healthcare Movie, narrated by Kiefer Sutherland, who is actually the grandson of Tommy Douglas, the premier of Saskatchewan, who was the driving force behind Canadian Medicare, the single-payer system that has provided healthcare, which is half the cost in the United States and actually achieves better or superior outcomes in terms of how patients actually do. So
yeah,
this is
clear.
We just have to go over the border to look at this. And there are many lies and falsehoods being told. People make up so-called facts out of their heads that have absolutely no basis.
Right.
But the Canadian healthcare system
works.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Dr. Abrams, A-B-R-O-N-S, from Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, PNHP.org. I want to thank you so much for your time today and all your work.
I'm so happy that you asked me to be on the show. Thank you.
Me too. Thanks a lot. Bye. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our archive shows. Check out the changes to our library card feature. Find out about our practice if you stream with this week's show, our book, and lots more. yourownhealthandfitness.org. Email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. All the links from today's show will be there. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. And remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.